Marianne Campbell. Welcome to a new series in Reason for Hope. This is the first of eight talks given by Al Stewart for City Bible Forum. The talks are called Ecclesiastes, An Honest Look at Life. Join me now as we listen to Al speak on Groundhog Day.
Every now and then I see my brother. He just recently moved from the Central Coast, but until just a little while ago he would drive 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours back to work on different building sites around the city. And when he'd work in the city and so on, he'd give me a call and I'd walk across and we'd go get a cup of coffee. And my brother's 2 years younger than me, and after his 4 hours a day commuting and so on, I'd say to him, "How are you, mate?" And he'd say, "Well, you've seen Groundhog Day, haven't you?" Now, can I ask, our eyes meet, I understand. How many of us have seen the movie Groundhog Day? Is that okay? Most of us. It's a very, very funny movie. I think it's Bill Murray's best movie. If you haven't seen it, it's the story of a television weatherman. And he's sent to some little town for the Groundhog Day ceremony, which is this funny American tradition where they get a groundhog out of the ground, and if it does something or other, winter's going to keep going. And I never quite got this part in the movie. But the movie works on the idea that Bill Murray, the town is snowed in, and the next morning when he wakes up, it's Groundhog Day again. And again, and again, and for 10, 20, 30, 100 days, just kind of endlessly, he wakes up and it's the same day, with the same people and the same things, and he's trapped in there and can't escape. It is a very funny movie to watch how he tries to cope with it. Now, Groundhog Day is a funny idea unless you're in it yourself. And I wonder whether sometimes you might feel like, well, every day is a bit the same because you woke up this morning and you get ready for work and then you get on the train or the bus or you drive and we come to work and then we work all day, which is pretty much the same as yesterday, and then we get home and we organise something to eat and fall asleep in front of the television and then get up and go to sleep and guess what? Get to do it all over again the next day. And the day after that, and the day after, and then we get to the weekend, and then on the weekend we get to wash clothes, that will get dirty again. We get to cook meals and get hungry again. We get to wash cars, that will get dirty again. We get to cut grass, that will get will grow again. And you get to do that. The good news is you get to do that for maybe 45, 50 years. Then you get to retire and have Groundhog Day in slow motion until until you die, I guess. It's just that feeling of, in the mornings I do the salmon kind of thing and walk against the flow. As people come out of the train at Town Hall Station and they walk away from the station, I'm walking the other direction to get my morning brain starter, cup of coffee at Michelle's thing there in the Town Hall Arcade. And as you walk past people, no one sees anything because everyone's just kind of walking along with their eyes set in the middle distance, just walking along with another Groundhog Day thing. And I wonder if that feeling is why sport is such a big thing in this country. When you actually stop and think about it, what is sport? Well, it's a bunch of people chasing a ball around a paddock, isn't it? Even playing the All Blacks is just a bunch of blokes chasing a ball around a paddock. And why do we elevate it in this country to the meaning of life? I wonder if because it's a distraction. It's something to fill our lives. It's something to get excited about. It's something that's not Groundhog Day and endlessly the same, and it's easier than trying to find a real answer. What does give life meaning and purpose? Why are we here? What's it all about? What has real value, real meaning? What will last? That is the great question that the book of Ecclesiastes asks. It's one of the wisdom books in the Bible. The wisdom books stand a little bit apart from the main storyline of the Bible. The main story of the Bible from Genesis through to Revelation is God setting out to rescue people who have walked away from him, the source of life. And that rescue mission revolves around the central focal person of Jesus Christ. The wisdom book stands slightly apart from that. They're about how to live in our world, how to try and make sense of the world we live in. Let me show you some of the wisdom books. The first of the wisdom books, and you'll find these in about the middle of the Bible, is the Song of Solomon, or sometimes called the Song of Songs. It's about being in love. It's a love story. It's not a great love poem, really. It's not particularly logical, but then what would you expect? It's about a celebration of love. The next one is very logical, and the book of Proverbs is set up really as the world. God has made our world in terms of cause and effect. And so act a certain way, there are consequences. Act wisely, you'll benefit. Act foolishly, you'll suffer. And that's true, isn't it? Up to a certain point. But there are harder questions than that. And so the book of Job looks at the question of suffering, and particularly undeserved suffering. When the innocent suffer, where is God? How do you make sense of that in our world? And then finally, the book of Ecclesiastes asks the question about what gives life meaning and purpose? What really matters? And what I like about this book is that it keeps asking the question and won't be put off with distractions or things that just because something's fun doesn't mean it has any value. So what gives life meaning, purpose, and so on? Well, let's have a look at the book. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, where does the name Ecclesiastes come from? You see the word there, teacher. In Hebrew, the word kohelet, what it means is someone who teaches people in the assembly, who gets people together and teaches them in a group or a crowd. The Greek word for assembly is ekklesia. That's where we get the word church from, ecclesiastical. So ecclesia, teaching in the assembly, Ecclesiastes, teaching the crowd. Who is speaking? Well, the teacher here calls himself the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And also in 1 verse 12, he says he was king over Israel. Now, it may well be Solomon, David's son, who was the greatest, the richest, the most prosperous of all the kings of Israel. He was the patron of the wisdom literature. He lived about 1000 BC, he reigned. And it may well be that towards the end of Solomon's life, he looked at all his achievements and so on and then wrote this book. But the book never actually says it's Solomon. So it could have been a subsequent writer who writes more or less through the eyes of Solomon. It says, I'm looking at the meaning of life, and what would Solomon have seen? As I go through these 8 talks and we work through Ecclesiastes, I'll just call him Solomon. That's the easiest way to refer to the writer. And Solomon begins in verse 2 by telling us how life appears. He says, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. What does he mean, meaningless? It's the Hebrew word hebel or hebel. 38 times in Ecclesiastes he says this, meaningless. The original meaning of the word is a breath or a vapour, something that's there and then not. I know this morning I was up early and outside, and as you walked along, you could breathe out and see the vapour that's there just for a second, and then it's gone. That's what he's meaning. It's a vapour, it's transitory. Sometimes the word is used about things that are worthless or trivial. When the translators of the King James Bible in the early 1600s came to translate this, they translated it vanity, which means not so much vain as in conceited, but in it's all in vain as in pointless, empty, nothing. When they came to translate the Hebrew into the Greek, have a Greek version of the Old Testament, they used the Greek word metaios, which means vanity or futility. It's futile, it's pointless. We'll come back to that in a moment. You notice here too, it's used in terms of its plural, that is, in the original, there's 5 times meaningless is said in this verse, and it's used in its plural in that what he says is meaninglessness of meaninglessnesses. It's the most meaningless. You see it in the Bible in terms of the Old Testament talks about the Holy of Holies, you know, the most holy place, or the Song of Songs, the most beautiful of songs. This is meaninglessness of it. If you're not used to the Bible, how about Dumb and Dumber? You kind of got the idea? Yeah, okay. If you have teenagers, you know that movie. It's dumb. Okay. What he's saying is everything is totally meaningless. Meaning everything is a vapour. It's transitory. Nothing lasts. Everything is a mist that's there and then gone. Everything's like that. And then he sets out for 12 chapters to prove it, to look at life and what we try and do to fill in our time and try and find meaning and purpose in different things. And he sets out to show that life is transitory, meaningless. It's a vapor. There's nothing substantial. How does he do that? Well, what he does is he asks a question and then he sets out to answer it. Here's the question that he asks. This question comes up a number of times in the book, in 1 verse 3. He says, what does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? Man or people, gain. What does he gain? The word is, I guess it's a bit like our word profit, as in the bottom line on something. It means, what's the gain? What's the surplus? What is left over? What continues? What lasts after we've done all of this? And the word labour there can mean hard work, drudgery and so on. Perhaps the most important phrase, though, is under the sun. 27 times in the book he talks about this little phrase, under the sun. And what he means is, this is the world view that Solomon's using in this book. And that is, if you just look out under the sun at our world, like a beautiful day today, the sun shining and so on, if you just look out at our world, without a special word from God, if the one who is beyond the sun hadn't spoken to us, if we just had this world, our eyes and common sense, well, how would we make sense of it? What do we see under the sun in just this world? And so he asks the question. And he says, really, for all our busyness, for all our activity, as we rush around, as we go to bed tired, as we wake up tired, as we do all of these things for year upon year upon year, what's it all worth? What's it amount to? What's the gain? What's the profit? Well, what he does in the that we're going to look at just for the, in the next few minutes, it's like almost a little overture that he introduces the themes, and where he starts is looking at the world around us. What is planet Earth like, and what does that teach us about life? So you'll see on the outline you were given, verses 4 to 7, the observation. Here he is as he looks at life. He says, generations come and generations go, but the Earth remains forever. The point being, we are so insignificant in terms of time. We're just here for a moment. A few years ago, the family and I, Kathy and I and the kids, did the Griswold family vacation thing, kind of drove around half of Australia. Went to Uluru, formerly Ayers Rock. And it's out in the outback, it's magnificently beautiful, but when we were there, the hard thing was getting a parking spot. There's so many people, there's so many tourists. And one of the local Aboriginal guys who works as a National Parks ranger there took a group of about 20 of us kind of rubberneck tourists around Uluru and talked to us about their culture and taught us things and so on. And he said they call the locals ants, as in the insects, ants. And I thought, why? And so on. And then went into the tourist centre and they had the tourist bus, a film of a tourist bus arriving and speeded up. Like kind of fast motion, and the tourists looked exactly like ants. And that is, they pull up at Uluru, they get out, they all mill around, some of them up the rock, some of them down, they mill around, and then they're back in the bus, whoosh, they're gone. And it was very instructive. Uluru stands there forever, and people come, whoosh, mill around, and then leave. It was instructive, but we had to go. We had places to be, and so we had to leave. Yeah, and that's what we're like. The earth remains forever, generations come and go, and they called ants. I kind of feel like we're bugs hitting the windscreen of eternity. We're just here for a little while and then we're gone. Huh? That's our lives. And then not only that, there's the monotony of the world. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. Now, he's not celebrating the consistency of nature, as elsewhere in the Bible, which is a very positive thing. Here he's saying it's always the same. It goes on and on and on in endless routine. As unpredictable as the wind, he's saying the wind's not unpredictable. As the weather systems move across the continent, the wind blows one way and then the wind blows the other, and it's as regular as clockwork. It happens again and again, and nothing is ever achieved. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All of that activity, all of the rain, all of the flowing of streams and the oceans never full. It's like a cosmic painting of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. That is, it's never finished. It's never achieved. Nothing ever happens. And so his reaction to this, when you look at it, his reaction, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. You can get bored with anything, he's saying. You know, what could be more exciting in life, really, than a roller coaster? My daughter Amy is a roller coaster junkie. You know, when we pull up outside theme park, she starts getting fidgety because she can't wait to get on. I just hold her bag. She goes on the roller coasters. I'm not stupid. Roller coasters, incredibly. But have you ever, you know, amusement parks, fun, amusing, you know, all that sort of thing. Have you ever looked at the staff in amusement parks? They're not amused, are they? Huh? They're bored out of their brains. Or on something that is kind of, I think, is exciting, barramundi fishing. On the same Griswold, you know, family vacation as we went to Uluru, we go to the Northern Territory, I paid someone an arm and a leg to take me barramundi fishing. Still didn't manage to catch one, but anyway. And the reason he had become a fishing guide, a barramundi fishing guide, is because he loved fishing. And there we are, fishing, trying to catch a barramundi, and he was, guess what, bored out of his brain. All things are wearisome. It doesn't matter what you do, it will become boring. Elton John sang in The Lion King, "From the moment we arrive on the planet and blinking step into the sun, there's more to see than can ever be seen, more to do than can ever be done." That may be true, but did you notice verse 8? The eye never has enough of seeing. And that is, we're never satisfied. The travel bug. One of my mates a little while ago had his first big overseas holiday. He went to Canada, he went to Whistler, he saw all sorts of things, went to the USA. And so now that satisfies the travel bug, right? Not at all. He came back. Do you know what he did for the next 3 months? He pored over travel brochures and felt depressed. Why? Because he wants to go more, see more things, or even something as trivial as television. In 1956, when television started, so that they could transmit the Olympic Games from Melbourne, only 5% of homes in Melbourne had a television and 1% of homes in Sydney had a television. Now, I don't know. I tried to find out what percentage of homes now have televisions. I was only able to do a little survey, and that was to survey my parents and my wife's parents. 4 people, and between them they have 8 televisions. So it's pretty good market penetration, really, isn't it? And I thought, well, surely now there's enough to watch, because we've got 4 channels that are 24 hours and another one that's most of the time, and no, that's not enough, is it? What we need is video libraries or DVD libraries that had thousands of movies that you could just hire, and that would be enough, wouldn't it? No. Cable television. 100 channels, and we could have them all the time, and then there would be. And you talk to people, and they, just like Bruce Springsteen sang, 57 channels and there's nothing on. The ear never has its fill of hearing. I want to know, why do we need more and more pop songs? Why haven't we got enough? We've got thousands of them. My son walks around with 2,000 in his pocket with his iPod. Why? And I mean it, 2,000. Why do we need more? Why can't the record companies just say, look, thanks, stop, no more. We've got enough, thanks. In fact, all you really need is the 80s, I think. That was about just that package. Well, I would have said the 70s, except you would have laughed at me even more. In fact, really, all you need is Bruce Springsteen's greatest hits. Those 20 songs are just... Anyway. After a while, I think you get to a certain age and life becomes boring. And you've done it again and again and again and life becomes dull. And you know what? I worked out that I managed to be stressed and bored at the same time. And I think that seems wrong. How can you be stressed and bored at the same time? And yet I am. And I think back, and maybe you can think the same, to years of being stressed out about so many deadlines and have my guts in a knot about things. And then I think back, what was it that I was so stressed about during that? And I can't even remember. And yet I'm stressed this week about deadlines this week that I won't remember in 6 months. And I wonder in the great irony that perhaps now in London, as people catch the tube to work with the bombings and so on, that the people there now are bored and afraid at the same time. It's a great irony of life, isn't it? And so his conclusion, what has been will be again, And what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. Do you remember I started reading the news? Just those kind of ordinary, everyday news stories, exports to China, treatment of Aboriginal people, investment in technical education, protests over immigration, colliery explosion, a movie about Ned Kelly and football teams and results. And then said, that's the news for August 05. Exactly right. Real news stories taken from the newspaper. Those news stories were lifted word for word from 1905. 100 years ago. And nothing ever changes. Nothing ever happens. The economy rises and falls in regular patterns. Interest rates go up and down and so on. We carry on about it, but it's just a regular pattern. You say, but wait, no, no. Computers, they're new. Or the space shuttle, it's new. Well, each little piece is new, but the march of technology is not new. It's been happening for thousands of years, since the time of Solomon. From the wheel to the space shuttle. And what happens? Well, it's never quite fast enough, is it? And the technology never answers the real problem, which is us. Because half the world still goes to bed hungry. And greed and selfishness and violence and so on, we can't fix it. So the march of technology is not new and nothing ever happens. I wonder if you remember, depends how old you are, Delamitri, the band, in their album Waking Hours, had a great song called Nothing Ever Happens. Came out in 89. Post office clerks put up signs saying position closed, and secretaries turn off typewriters and put on their coats, and janitors padlock the gates for security guards to patrol, and bachelors phone up their friends for a drink while the married ones turn on a chat show, and they'll all be lonely tonight and lonely tomorrow. Gentlemen, time please, you know we can't serve any more. Now the traffic lights change to stop when there's nowhere to go, and 5 o'clock everything's dead, and every third car is a cab, and ignorant people sleep in their beds like the doped white mice in the college lab, and here's the chorus, which is brilliant. Nothing ever happens. Nothing happens at all. The needle returns to the start of the song, and we'll all sing along like before, and we'll all be lonely tonight and lonely tomorrow. Great song, and you sing along to it till you start to think about the words and think, oh, yeah, that's... Now, it's not all like this. It gets worse. Verse 11, no one will remember us. We're here for 5 minutes. We're bored. We're stressed. We're frightened, but no one will remember us. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. No one will remember. Little quiz. Don't say out loud. If you know who any of these men are, would you just raise your hand, please? Okay. About 5% of us, I guess. 5%. Who were they? Well, just Australian Prime Ministers. Now, that's the top job in the country within the last 100 years, and 95% of people don't even know who they are. I don't think I would have either. I cheated, but you know, that's... Now, no one knows. You say, oh, yes, but you know, they were just politicians. But our family will remember us, will they? My wife's grandfather, the Chinese man I never got to meet, but he got on a boat from, I think it was Canton, and ended up in Bougainville in New Guinea to try and find somewhere to work. He had an amazing life. He supported a wife back in China. He got a second wife in New Guinea, supported them both, started a new family, and Kathy was his grandchild, born in New Guinea, and started a business and an amazing life. Now, do you know what his great-grandchildren know about him? Almost nothing. Do you know how much they care? Not at all. And he'll be forgotten. And do you think anyone will remember you or me? And that's if you get to have great-grandchildren. No one remembers. No one really cares. We're gone and forgotten. So there's the summary. And this is his warm-up. This is how we are under the sun. Remember, under the sun. The world goes on forever in an endless routine. We're only here for 5 minutes, and while we're here, it gets tedious, and nothing ever changes, and no one will remember us. Now, here's the thing. Why does that feel wrong? Why can't we just say, yeah, well, that's the way it is. Let's go watch sport and distract ourselves. Why is it we say, well, it just doesn't feel right. There's got to be more to... Why has every society through human history tried to find meaning and purpose? It's because we're hardwired that way, and it just doesn't feel right. And it's not right. It's not the way it was meant to be. Our Creator made us to know Him, to have meaning and purpose, and that feeling of frustration, futility, emptiness, vanity, it's the heavy hand of God on our world. Let me show you what the Apostle Paul writes to the Christians in Rome, where he talks about this kind of burden that God has put on our world. He says, "The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed," meaning that the children of God one day will be shown. "For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it," namely God. God put frustration on our world in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. "We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time." Now that word frustration that's underlined, that is the same word, metaites, that was used when they translated the Ecclesiastes word for meaningless into Greek. He's saying it's meaningless, it's vain, it's a breath, a vapour. It's that same frustration, that feeling of Groundhog Day, that God's put that on our world. And our world groans under it. And why has He done that? Why is that? Because our world has walked away from God, who's the source of life. And we feel it. It's not the way it should be. And just as pain is an indication that something's wrong in our body, so this feeling is an indication that something's wrong in our world. And the story of the Bible is God's great rescue mission to save us from the consequences of that, of walking away from the one who's the source of life. Now you may think, well, there's got to be something that gives life meaning and purpose under the sun. I'd invite you to come back over the next 7 weeks as we walk with Solomon through his quest to find meaning and purpose.